Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
Hello, snack lovers. Curb your cravings with My Mochi ice cream. Imagine a scoop of rich, creamy, premium ice cream in your favorite flavor. Now imagine that scoop wrapped up in the sweetest, softest dough known to mankind. That's My Mochi ice cream. Sweet, chewy, cool, and creamy, all in one bite. It's quite possibly the most joyfully chill sensation you've ever had in your life. My Mochi ice cream comes in tons of fabulous flavors, like strawberry, mango, cookies and cream, and double chocolate. Each box of My Mochi ice cream has 6 perfectly portioned mochis that are about 80 calories each, and it's also gluten-free. You can find My Mochi at Target or visit MyMochi.com to find a grocery store near you. That's MyMochi.com. Discover the joyfully chill sensation of My Mochi ice cream today.
Hey, everybody. We got a harrowing but funny one today because my guest is Senator Tammy Duckworth. Her book, Every Day is a Gift, is both harrowing and really funny. And it chronicles her life with a focus on her being shot down, the pilot of a Black Hawk helicopter in Iraq, and her rehabilitation. And as I say, unbelievably harrowing. But also, we had a great time discussing this, and she has a wonderful, wonderful sense of humor, and so do I. So, so it's a harrowing but funny one for a change. Well, Liz Cheney is willing to give up her leadership post in the Republican House caucus. She's been third in leadership as conference chair. The conference chair actually has no formal defined role. It's really kind of a plum that you get for being a either a well-known or very promising popular figure with some promise in the party. Liz Cheney took a stand. She says that the presidential election was not stolen by Joe Biden. Very brave, very brave. She must be one of those people that, I don't know, thinks God is keeping track of everything. Look, the truth is that all God cares about is whether you consider him God or not. He's very, very status-driven, and what matters to him more is not so much who believes in him, but whoever does, the higher their status, the better. So he's thrilled that the woman replacing Liz Cheney, Elise Stefanik, the 36-year-old representative from, I believe, the Albany area of New York, is someone who claims, at least, that she worships him. And whether it's true or not, God doesn't really care. It's just, so it's all kind of awkward. On Thursday, Mitch McConnell was asked about that flap, specifically the Liz Cheney flap, and to avoid having to say anything about that awkward situation, he deliberately made news by saying he wasn't giving that matter any thought, but instead said, 100% of my focus is on standing up to this administration. What we have in the United States Senate is total unity, from Susan Collins to Ted Cruz, in opposition to what the new Biden administration is trying to do to this country. And, of course, that's exactly what he did during the Barack Obama administration. He filibustered more executive appointees than had been filibustered previously in the entire history of the country. And, of course, all kinds of legislation, and that was mainly what the hell he did. But evidently, he miscalculated, you know, a tad, because his pollsters must have pointed out to him that a lot of Biden's agenda, if not a vast majority of his agenda, is very popular with the American people. So he was asked about that again the next day. Mr. Leader, are you really just willy-nilly going to oppose everything President Biden is going to try to do?
We have to see what that agenda is.
And the press, you know, they just went, eh. And McConnell reverses himself on a dime. That's not a story. So, it's a great time to be on the Hill. Hey, we've got a great one today. Harrowing, but funny. You know, for a change. Because Tammy Duckworth is with me today, the great Tammy Duckworth. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Thank you, Tammy, for joining me today. This is your second time on the podcast. You joined us for about 5 minutes last September after the Atlantic Monthly reported that Trump didn't want amputees to attend military parades because he reportedly said no one wants to see that. So, thank you.
Well, at least we don't have to see him anymore. So that there's something, there's been an improvement.
Yeah, no one wants to see that. I'll tell you that. And and by the way, thank you for being grievously wounded.
That cracks me up every time.
That's kind of a, it's not an inside joke. It's in the damn book. Yeah.
It's not an inside joke anymore.
Yeah, I came to, I used to do USO tours. So I came, I visited you and at Walter Reed a number of times. And I'd take Polaroids with the soldiers there who were wounded. And I'd write, thank you for your service. And at a certain point, you said, people don't really like that.
Well, it's just everybody says it, and it becomes a little bit meaningless because it's not said with like real meaning behind it, you know? And we appreciate that.
Yeah, and I did not mean it.
No.
Yeah, so you said don't sign a thank you for your service. So that's when I started writing thank you for being grievously wounded. And man, it got a laugh every time.
Hey, they all love it. We all love it. Because we know that there's like a personal engagement. That's the difference. You know, we used to call it, I talk about this in the book, we used to call it the amputee petting zoo. And you knew who was there for you and who was there just for the, you know, photo and the press release. And you were there for us.
I read that in the book and you said that someone would bring in a professional photographer and take a picture and then they'd leave with the picture.
And you would never see the picture until you saw it in a press release or something later on. And you're like, okay, they're not there for me. They're just there for themselves.
That's really weird. That is so weird. Because I've been doing these USO tours, I was asked if I wanted to go to Walter Reed, and I said, well, of course. But the first time I went there, I was so scared. I thought to myself, how am I supposed to cheer these guys up, you know? And so the first guy there I saw was leaning up against a wall, and his leg was missing. And I said to him, what happened to you? And he said, you know, I came in here for a vasectomy. And then I went, oh, I get it. Okay. And then I was fine, you know, yeah. And then I just had a good time. We had a good time when I saw you.
You came in the evening after, you know, a long day of me being really tired and everything. You came in the evening and perked me up. It was nice.
Well, boy, this is a harrowing book in terms of what you went through in your recovery. You, man, oh, man. It's pretty grisly. You get hit by a rocket-propelled grenade, RPG, right?
Yep. Uh-huh.
In your Black Hawk.
Yeah.
And it pretty much explodes, like, kind of hits you.
It does. It explodes in my lap, yeah. It basically hits my right leg. There ain't nothing left of that leg.
Yeah, that's gone.
That's gone, yep.
It's very harrowing, and you speak so highly, you write so highly of all the guys on your crew and on the other crew that came down there, but they did assume you were dead for part of it, and then they saw, no, you're still bleeding, so that means you're pumping blood, so your heart's still going, but gee whiz, wow, holy mackerel, wow, that it was friggin' horrible. And then the recovery is even in many ways the pain you describe and the phantom pain and the, well, I don't want to ruin the book here. I don't want to ruin any surprises.
Well, you know what? This is like, you're talking about the middle of the book when like, this is like the most, you know, this is the harrowing shoot down. But I hope you laughed out loud at different parts of the book because I talk about my childhood in Southeast Asia and coming to the U.S. for the first time.
I did not know that you spent essentially, well, you did. You spent your first 16 years in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, following my dad around. My dad was a Vietnam vet and decided he didn't want to come back to the States. So he just kept us overseas. And so I was like a military brat, but with United Nations refugee programs, basically. He was bringing aid to refugees all throughout Southeast Asia.
And your mom is Chinese Thai or Thai Chinese?
She's
ethnically Chinese.
Ethnically Chinese, born and raised in Thailand. She's the first child and only child in her family born in Thailand. Because her parents fled. They were you know, a small town shopkeepers, but they fled Mao Zedong. They fled the communists.
And there's a lot of ups and downs in your childhood in terms of your family's economic status and your dad at first doing pretty well and then not so well and finally, at age 16, you, your brother, and your dad go to Hawaii, leaving your mom back there. And then Hawaii ain't so hot either in terms of, your dad seems to be hitting the bottom there, right?
He is, yeah. In the book, I describe it almost like he kept trying to find the kind of job that he had, where he was a managing director or something, you know, a big job. And he was in his 50s, but at this point, he had been unemployed for 5 years. We had no money left. We were in Hawaii because it was the cheapest place we could get to in terms of a plane ticket from Thailand that was U.S. soil. And so what I needed...
He's an American, so you can go there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so what we needed was for him to go get a job as a hotel porter or a front desk guy or something. And he just wouldn't apply for those. He was in denial. And so we hit rock bottom where, you know, but for the grace of a 90-year-old lady with the American Legion Auxiliary who wrote us a personal check, we would have been homeless.
Yeah, well, she saves your ass as soon as you arrive there, basically. Mm-hmm. But then you save your family's ass, or at least your brother and your dad, by hustling a little bit, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I got the only job, you know, in the family. I handed out flyers on the beach in Waikiki, you know. I had to figure out at 16 who I should hit up with the booze cruise flyers versus the romantic dinner cruise flyers. Here's a snap judgment.
Yeah, and that trained you, of course, for the Senate.
Well, you know what it was at preparing for the Senate? It was hustling on the beach volleyball court, pretending to not know what I was doing.
Now, that was hustling, by the way. That was, it was like you're a pool shark, except you're a volleyball shark.
Yeah.
So you'd be walking in your, like, a bikini and a sarong. What else? What were you wearing?
A sarong. Yeah, I would. There is a next to the Hilton Hawaiian Holiday Resort. There's a beach volleyball court that Howleys, mainlanders would come and you know, basically fraternity bros would come and, you know, and I'd hang out there in my bikini with my sarong on, sitting on the beach, just looking out to the ocean. And I had like this guy that I didn't know him very well, but I, you know, he's another local, and he would play with them, and then they would, you know, challenge him to a match, and he would just pick me because, you know what, I'll just pick her.
And they go, and then oh, we would kick okay. Their
yeah.
And then you kick their ass.
Yeah. So it'd be two guys against him, he and I. Yeah.
And then they'd break your thumbs. Wait a minute, that's The Hustler. That's a different movie.
No, that's a different movie. No, yeah. I knew when to get out. I knew when to leave once I made, you know. I wasn't greedy, Al. I just needed to make enough money to buy, you know, enough food for the family for the week, so.
Yeah, and that was a pretty modest place. That was, you slept on essentially a couch and there. And then you got your mom there finally, and you moved to, you go to the University of Hawaii.
Yep.
And your family moves to Virginia, where your dad is from. Mm-hmm. Oh, I want to ask you about something there, right? Your brother, Tom,
yep.
You say he's like a boogie boarder, and he is so good that he's at 15 going to get a contract or something.
Yep.
I'm going like, I've boogie boarded. It's the easiest thing in the world. Now, how good can you get at boogie boarding?
Very good. They go out on those big waves like the surfers do, that, you know, pipeline stuff. I mean, they go out on those waves that kill you.
Oh, okay.
So there's like whole competitions for money and everything with boogie boarding. And so he got really, really good. And then my folks left for Virginia and took him with them because there's no way they were going to leave him.
He was 15.
Behind. Yeah, he was 15.
That is the most relaxing thing I've ever done in my life.
Oh yeah, not the way Tom does it.
Well, no. Yeah. Well, the way I did it, which is just in Hawaii, you can catch wave after wave after wave after wave.
Yep,
as easy as pie, and it's just like perfect. And a boogie board, you don't have to do anything. Yeah. You have fins, so you can move a little bit. And oh my god, so okay, now I understand that. That was really dangerous.
Yeah, well, he would go in the pipelines and they do like flips and spins and all sorts of stuff.
Okay, you know? I didn't do that.
I would pay to see you do that. Actually, Al, you could turn pro.
You'd pay to see me break my neck and die. Okay, so now we got you now to Hawaii, and then you graduate from college there, mm-hmm. and then you go to graduate school. But then you join the Army.
Yes.
Okay, I got the order right. You meet Brian at an advanced boot camp kind of thing?
I did 2 years of ROTC instead of 4 years. So in order to do that, I had to go to basic training, which equaled the first 2 years. And then I had a year, which was my junior year of ROTC. That happened to be Brian's senior year. He was an upperclassman. So the fourth year cadets trained the third year cadets. So this was the in-between year when the fourth year cadets were training us, getting us ready to go to the advanced camp the next summer.
So we would get evaluated. So he's training you.
They're just the upperclassmen cadets, and they're training you. So you would go off, you know, like we would go off to Fort Meade, Maryland for a long weekend, and they would make us, you know, do a grenade assault course, and they would make us, you know, run around, play infantry in the woods. You know, do prisoner of war searches and things like that.
So what was his pickup line?
The women at advanced camp are fucked up.
That's his pickup line. That's what got you.
That's not what got me. That got my attention and that pissed me off. And apparently he saw that it pissed me off. So he came over afterwards and apologized and helped me clean my M16. And by the time we were done cleaning my M16, he had my phone number. He's pretty smooth.
Okay, but this is how smooth he is, because I read that chapter, and he both apologizes for that and then later denies that he said it.
Yes, to this day, he says,
okay,
to this day, he says, that's not the real story. He said, the official story of our family is that he said it, because that's what happened. But he claims that the real story, which is his version, which is not the official, you know, sanctioned story, is that it was another guy who said it, but he agreed with him. As if that's any better.
So basically your marriage is based on a lie. But man, oh man, he's there for you and is dealing with something after your blowed up.
I blowed up good.
And the description of the pain is, because I don't know about our listeners, I don't like pain.
Yeah, me
and
either.
If you don't like pain, folks, read this book and you get an idea of like, holy crap, I don't know how she did this. Because there's phantom pain, like your feet, you're still feeling your feet burning, right?
Yeah, I get phantom pain to this day. So I have phantom sensation where I feel my toes, I can wiggle them. That's actually for me kind of pleasant mentally because it feels like I still have toes. But I feel like the soles of my feet are constantly walking on hot sand. So that I feel that 100% of the time.
Okay. And then the other stuff is much worse than that.
It's, the breakthrough phantom pain kind of
and
sucks.
You pass out from the pain. And, mm-hmm. and then, but you have people come, other people who are amputees, who come to Walter Reed and are with you and yeah. really save your life in many ways, right?
Yeah. I think to this day, Juanita Wilson saved my life because at one point the pain was so bad, I didn't know that I could survive. It's funny because I got hit with the RPG and I wasn't worried about surviving. I was worried about landing the helicopter. I get into the emergency room at Baghdad ER and I'm just worried about my guys. I'm not worried about surviving. But the only time when I'm actually worried and I think that I'm not going to live, I can't take this pain anymore. Sergeant First Class Juanita Wilson comes into my room, takes off her artificial limb and stands next to me and just says, it's going to get better. Can I help you count? And I had been reduced at this point to counting to 60 seconds. At a time, because I thought, I don't know that I'll live another 15 minutes, but maybe I can hang on for 60 seconds. And I was just laying there. I laid there for 5 days counting to 60 seconds, and she stood beside me.
Is that a phenomenon that you kind of get, if you give up, you die?
I don't know.
You think?
I think.
That's what it felt like, right?
That's what it felt like. It felt like if I stopped counting, I would die.
When she told you it gets better, that kept you going.
Yeah. And she just stood and she radiated without touching me because she was the one person who understood. Like my mom would come and stroke my hair or lean against the bed to stroke my hair. And that everything that touched me, even somebody touching one end of the bed and the sheets would move, just sent like shooting pain through my body. But I had no more energy left to even say, stop, that hurts. I just had to take it. All the energy I had left was just left. All I could do was just breathe and try to count. I couldn't even waste a breath to say, stop, mom, that hurts. But Juanita understood and she stood next to my bed and she didn't touch me. She just radiated this peace, this serenity that it was a tiny little thread of hope. And I just clung to that.
And there are a number of people like that in your book who come back all the time to Walter Reed and who, you know, the double amputee who, his wife was a cookie lady and he was sort of the, how to have sex guy. That wasn't the way you put it.
Yeah. This is the Porter, the Tom and L Porter are Korean War veterans. At the time he was like 76 or 78. And just tall, distinguished, silver-haired, good old boy from Oklahoma. His wife is from New Hampshire, Vermont, and she's she's a Korean War veteran as well. So she was a lieutenant herself. They met, you know, at the hospital where she was a physical therapist, and they became the sex talk couple. Like, you know, these 18-year-old guys who lost both their legs, badly scarred. You know, they didn't know if a girl was ever going to love them. And Tom and L. Porter would be there and say, "We found love after he lost his legs." And you can ask us anything. And they became the sex talk couple.
You write him saying like to these double amputee guys, oh man, you'll get women.
Oh yeah. He would tell them, It's better than having a puppy.
It's a conversation starter.
Yeah.
Now, again, I go back to these things. You lost 50% of your blood, right?
Yeah, we think so, something like that. I mean, it took 40 units, which I don't know how much is in a human body. But
and most people, yeah, like, would say you're half empty, but I'm an optimist, and I like to think that you're half full.
Yeah.
See, that's me.
And leaking in a lot of places. They had to plug me back up in a lot of spots.
Now, tell me about, I think this happened before, like maybe a day or two before I met you, that Rumsfeld came to see you.
Oh, yeah.
It was there. And they asked, they came into your room and said, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld is here. And of course, you would like to see the Secretary of Defense.
And I said, heck no. And then they did a double take. And they said, what? I said, well, if it's an order, he's in my chain of command. I'll have to see him. But if it's not an order, then I don't want that man crossing the threshold of my door.
And then the next day, I love this. That's the first time they sent you a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
You've lost both legs, the use of one arm, no psychiatrist.
No psychiatrist.
You like won't a couple
months
see.
In. I've been there a couple months. Yeah.
You've been a couple? No psychiatrist.
Yeah.
You won't see the guy who blew this war, who sent two few people in, who had no plan, who basically said, oh, this will take a few weeks, maybe at most a few months.
They'll meet us with candy and flowers.
Yep.
His words. Yeah. They'll greet us with candy and flowers.
And you don't want to see them. And they're going like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, they said a colonel. I mean, like, they didn't send me like some, you know, brand new, you know, resident captain. They sent me a full-bird colonel psychiatrist, like the head of the department, to come see me.
You know what's interesting? I did a lot of USO tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I learned a lot on the. I want to ask you about this because I know you're on armed services, and I took a CODEL trip with Carl Levin my first year there. To Afghanistan, and met with the ambassador, stayed at the embassy, met with the ambassador. I met Karzai. I spent time with McChrystal. I went to a forward operating base. I met with the general who's training the Afghan troops. I learned nothing. They just told me what they were told to tell me, basically. And nothing they told me actually happened and came true. But I felt like when I did the USO tours, and you must be serving there, my God, I felt I learned a lot more. I mean, we would go to these DFACs, to the dining facilities for our listeners, you know, 3-4 times a day, and we'd be there for almost a couple of weeks. And I could see guys who wanted to talk.
Yeah.
And I'd hear everything. I'd hear guys who are gung-ho. I'd hear guys who hated the war or against the war, but were there for their buddies, right? Like you, yeah. I think.
Yeah, I hated the war. I didn't agree with the war in Iraq, but I was not going to shirk my post and certainly was not going to let my unit go off to war without me.
Right. And that was pretty much a leitmotif of yours when you were at Walter Reed, which is, I want to get back with my unit.
Yeah, but Al, all the times that you went to Walter Reed, how many of the guys did not say that to you? How many of the troops did you talk to? Every one of them said to you that they wanted to go back to their unit, right?
A lot of them did. It wouldn't be everybody, but you were pretty vociferous about it. I mean, that impressed me. You were very vociferous about it. And this was very early on, I think, the first time I saw you.
This was hot. It was hot in Iraq. I mean, hottest in the battles were hot. Right then, you know, Al, it was, I got hurt during the second battle for Fallujah. And
was this 04?
This was 04, end of 04, November of 04. And frankly, I felt guilty being at Walter Reed with my buddies still in harm's way. And I was safe and people were bringing me gifts and saying nice things to me. And my buddies were still getting shot at.
It sounds like it's easy to make you feel guilty.
I don't know. You know, as an officer, you know, as a soldier, you don't want your buddies in harm's way and you're safe.
I know, but you lost two legs. I mean, come on. I feel guilty.
I didn't say it was logical. And I was kind of medicated at the time. Well, no, I wasn't kind of. I was medicated at the
time.
Yeah,
sounds like you're medicated a lot. And the worst part, one of the worst parts to me was the antibiotics, because you got some kind of common bacteria that are infection.
Yeah, Acetobacter. It's a antibiotic resistant bacteria that like 95%. If you had open wounds in Iraq, 95% of the troops with wounds came back with it. Yeah.
So you're getting this all the time and it's making you nauseous. So you can't eat or you don't want to eat. I got to say, it sounded unpleasant.
It was. It was unpleasant. Yeah. That's why there's a whole chapter called Own the Suck in the book.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Own the Suck. We're talking to Tammy Duckworth. We're going to be back right after this message.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Late nights at work taking a toll on your skin? Do you find yourself staring at those dark circles in the mirror? Well, it's time to meet your new best friend, Dark Circle Defense Balm from Lumen. Lumen is a line of brilliant men's skincare solutions crafted especially for men who want to look and feel their brightest. Whether you're a seasoned skincare pro or a total newbie, Lumen Skin has got you covered. Lumen's Dark Circle Defense Balm is a lightweight gel that absorbs seamlessly into your skin to brighten your under eyes and instantly plump dehydration lines. It's basically an espresso shot for your eyes. The best part? Lumen will let listeners of this podcast try the product out for free. Yes, you heard that right. Free. Head to lumenskin.com/wondery and get your free trial of Dark Circle Defense and their other amazing products now. Say goodbye to tired looking eyes and say hello to a new and refreshed you. Don't wait any longer. Your skin will thank you. That's lumenskin.com/wondery for your free trial.
Let me ask you about what's going on now in the Senate.
Yeah.
Let's talk about, I guess it looks like you got one more crack at a reconciliation, right?
Yep. Yep.
And what's that going to be? Infrastructure, you think?
That'll be infrastructure. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, in order to do anything else, like, you know, Senate Bill 1, which is the Voting Rights Act, I mean, there's no way. There's you have to be pretty creative to justify the Voting Rights Act as a budget bill.
Yeah, that's not going to. Parliamentarian isn't going to allow that.
Yeah, so that we'll have to change the filibuster.
You got this guy Manchin and Sinema.
Yeah,
and this is what I think Manchin may be doing, and I don't know this for sure, but I carefully read his op-ed in the Washington Post about this, in which he said he doesn't want to end the filibuster or weaken it. But then he did say something about the Republicans have to, he wanted to get to regular order, basically, where you write bills in committee, they go to the floor, you have open amendments, you vote on the amendments, and then you vote on the bill. That's the way we used to do things, right?
I have no idea. I've never seen that either when I was in the House or the Senate. I've never seen this phenomenon called regular order.
Yeah, we actually kind of did that. Now, to me, looking at the Republicans and the way they have behaved for the last several years, that ain't going to happen. So I don't know if, there are a lot of people who you know, liberals who criticize Joe, they have to realize that if Joe weren't there, we wouldn't be in the majority.
Exactly.
And he's from a state that went for Trump by 40%.
Yep.
So God bless him. And he's a politician. And I don't know this for sure, but I think he's basically saying to the Republicans, let's see you play ball. You know, there's all this thing like, well, Biden has to work with the Republicans. Hey, the Republicans have to work with Biden. A little bit. I mean, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and the next thing that's on the agenda is going to be the infrastructure package, and that's something that they should want. Now, we've broken out the water infrastructure package because I got to lead that, and it's coming up this week. That passed out of committee unanimously, so I think we're going to move that on its own. So we know that Republicans like infrastructure, and they want and need infrastructure. So let's see them play ball. But there's always the talking filibuster too, right? So, and Manchin has left the door open for that. He said, well, I would consider a talking filibuster potentially.
Yes. I mean, I have proposed with Norm Ornstein, and I think this is now out there pretty much, changing it from we need 60 to stop a filibuster to they need 41 to continue a filibuster. So in other words, mm-hmm. It's the same number. Right?
Yep.
It's just...
You got to get 40 other people 41, to agree that
41.
You're a filibuster. Well, you would be one, and then you need 40 other people to agree with you that you want to maintain the filibuster, right?
Right, right. And you'd have to show up.
Yeah.
As opposed to just say, I have one guy saying, I object, and then you have to come up with 60. No, this means you have to... The point of the filibuster is if the minority really cares about something, they can filibuster. Mm-hmm. But right now, all they have to do is somebody has to say, I object, and you got a filibuster. And that's not what it was.
Correct. Yeah, they can go home and go on vacation or go to Cancun.
Exactly. The first week I was there, did you serve with Jim Bunning at all?
No.
Oh, was he a crabby guy? Wow. Anyway, I'm there. The first week I'm there, we go to do the Thursday votes, as you know, our audience may or may not know, that's the last vote of the week. And then you go there to the subway to go to your office and then go to the airport and go to your state and work, you know, do the weekend. So this, I'm there the first week, and I did not know that Jim was a grumpy guy. So I said, hey, Jim, have a great weekend. I'll see you on Monday. And he goes, I don't have to be here on Monday. It's going to be a cloture vote. And then I said, well, Jesus, that's okay. So they don't have to even show up, and they're filibustering, but we're the burden's on us. And at that point, we had 59 because Teddy was sick. This is going to take some while to play out, but I hope you're right. I mean, Trump talked about, remember every week was infrastructure week with him? And And he was the big builder, remember? He's a big builder. Yep. And he was going to do a $1 trillion infrastructure bill. And never got to it at all. And you'd think everyone would be for that, especially with him. I mean, you know, we would have been for it. Anyway.
They could never get their act together. Instead, the way that they originally said they were going to pay for it was to lower the tax rate to get dollars that companies are keeping overseas repatriated. But then when they got the deal, instead of taking that $1 trillion from overseas money to, you know, that corporations would bring back to the U.S., instead of putting that into infrastructure, they just gave it back to the large corporations and the riches of the rich, who then turn around and use it to buy back stocks.
That's right. And they got richer. No, it's quite, I mean, there's no excuse. I don't know what you guys can do in terms of getting these Republicans. I mean, it sounds like on the crime bill, maybe there's some cooperation. It'd be nice to see some of that. But what I saw, like on the COVID Relief Act, which was, you know, the 10 of them come to the White House and they counter $1.9 trillion with $600 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that serious? Why is that like we're going to work with you?
Yeah. I listen, It boggles the mind that not a single Republican, not a single one voted for the American Rescue Plan. All the things that they voted against, you know, they voted against more money for immunizations. They voted against money to get our public schools open. They voted against putting $1,400 into people's pockets so that they can pay their back rent and their utility bills.
And it was amazingly popular with the American people, like
desperately
almost 70%.
And by the way, Janet Yellen said, if we don't get this out the door, we go into a recession. We go into a free fall. And that's what she's saying about the infrastructure package that we're looking at. You know, she's saying, listen, you need to pass this because this will stimulate the economy. If you don't do this, we will be stuck in stagnation for as long as, you know, several years. You get this infrastructure bill out, this money, yeah, it's got a big price tag, but it's not going to go to, you know, companies that are buying back stocks, right? This money will go into...
It goes to infrastructure.
It will go to infrastructure. It's going to go into like every local community. You know, it's going to go not just to fix the pothole in front of your you know, the road in Main Street. It's going to go to the diner on Main Street because the people who work on that pothole are going to go eat at that diner. This money goes into the economy, will actually generate growth.
It really goes to things like, I'll go to communities where the train track is between the hospital and the town. And like, and they have a train that takes 20 minutes to go with carrying oil. And the ambulance has to wait there for 20 minutes. I mean, what you want to do is build an underpass, you know, and you want our airports to like at least resemble in quality the airports in Europe and all of that stuff. At the end of the day, you'll get a world-class infrastructure. That's what we need. And you'll have people have jobs in the meantime. Oh, I know what I wanted to ask you. Hawley.
I mean.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry to laugh because I have a dark sense of humor. I know you do too.
I do. Okay. I do. I mean.
But okay, for the listener, he is the only one who voted against extending hate crime law to ethnic Asians, right?
Yep. All we did was, you know, we passed legislation that basically made sure that Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders were a recognized group that are on the receiving end of hate crimes, and asking for a bigger look into the Justice Department's data to see how many crimes involving Asian Americans were actually hate crimes, were never reported as such. And he voted against that.
And the only
one guy.
Okay. So that's, what was his reasoning exactly? Did you go up to him afterwards and go like, hey, I disagree with you?
Oh,
but we're pals,
he did
right?
One of those pop his head in the back, thumbs down, and then popped out again kind of vote right at the end too. So, you know, I think what he has said in public is he was worried about freedom of speech.
Okay.
Because, you know, if you use a racial slur against an Asian while you're committing a crime, that's one of the signals that it's a hate crime. But he says, well, that's freedom
okay.
of speech.
So like, that is actually the signal that it is a hate crime.
Right. Right.
Otherwise, it could be just a garden variety robbery or something, right?
Yeah.
But then if you add, if you use your freedom of speech to say something racist.
Yeah. Then it becomes a hate crime.
Yeah.
But he was worried about the freedom of speech implications.
That's bizarre. I remember Rand Paul, one of the first votes he cast was one of these where he was the only one to vote against something. And it was, okay, it was this. There was a certain point where people were shining lasers into the cockpits
pilots.
The blind pilots as they were landing at airports. To make that illegal and make it a crime, a federal crime, passed 99-1, and Rand Paul voted against it. And I went up to him. I said, "What the hell was that?" And he goes, "Well, that should be up to the states." And I said, "What could be more interstate commerce than an airport than a fly?"
They flew in from somewhere else.
I can't think of anything.
But in his defense, sometimes he goes so far right, he ends up on the left and helps us in votes here and there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, he'll be for being able to smoke pot or that kind of stuff, right? Yeah.
Yep.
For prison reform, maybe, I think.
Yep. Yep. Right? He goes so far right and so far libertarian that he comes back on the left. So.
Yeah. God bless him. Mm-hmm. But, you know, not really. No. God bless everyone. Okay. This George Floyd crime bill, the police and Justice and Policing Act.
Do you have any insight
into that? What's going on with that?
Well, that is actually in some negotiations right now, where it may actually be moving a little bit. So Cory Booker is leading it up this time. All that he said has been very cryptic, but you know, she's like, "I'm hopeful we're engaging in some productive negotiations." That's all I got to say. That's all I want to say. So it's something that could move. And I guess there are Republicans who are actively engaging with him and negotiating it. And I've got something in that bill as well, which I think is something that Republicans should be able to support. My Police Education and Independent Investigation Act, that's been looped into that. And what that does is it creates grant money for police forces so that they can use it for training. And the training must include understanding about racial inequities and potential racist structures within society. So if you do police training, it would also involve that component. And then the big part of the bill is actually mandatory independent investigations of police-involved shootings and violence. So that usually what happens, it's the local district attorney's office that will come in and investigate when there's a police-involved shooting, for example. But that local district attorney's office relies on that same police department to help them win cases.
Yeah.
And so my bill would actually require anytime there's a police-involved shooting or violence that an independent a board comes in. And that's one that I don't see it. How could anybody, you know, disagree with that?
Yeah. The President Obama had a task force on this. And we actually had Charles Ramsey, who was the former police chief from Philadelphia and D.C. Mm-hmm. on that. And they had a number of these, one about sensitivity to ethnic and language and race of your community.
Yes.
And encouraging that. So that's what you're talking about, right?
I am, yes. And that, you know, there are also things that have to do with people with disabilities as well. A lot of people who are hearing impaired are victims of police-involved violence, just because the police officer is shouting at them and they can't hear and they're not responding. And the police officers don't realize this is someone who is hard of hearing. And so the hard of hearing actually are have a much higher percentage of being involved in police-involved shootings and violence.
And there needs to be training. There needs to be a force that's reflective of the community, including language, right?
Including language, exactly. And then also, you know, what we need is more funding for programs so that a lot of the times when somebody calls 911 and they're asking for help, they don't need a police officer. They need a substance abuse specialist to come to the door. They need a mental health, you know, specialist who knows where there is a mental health bed that, you know, the person in your family is having a crisis can go to.
Well, you know, it's crisis intervention training is what we're talking about there. And it's interesting. We had on this podcast Judge Steve Leifman from Miami-Dade, and they basically have really emphasized crisis intervention training. And they have crisis intervention teams, including the 911 operators. And, you know, when you're saying, like, someone calls 911, sometimes when someone calls and there's a domestic dispute and you want to send someone, they ask a certain list of questions. And depending on the answers, they may send a social worker.
Yes.
As opposed to sending cops, which is really smart. And they have crisis intervention teams all over the place in Miami, and they've reduced the number of shootings in Miami from like 90 over a five-year period to like 16 over the last five-year period.
Wow.
So it's there's lots of stuff to do here. Now, qualified immunity, is that a sticking point or is that something? Yeah,
that's a sticking point. That's, I think, where they're negotiating. That's where, you know, a big chunk of the negotiation is happening.
That's an issue about whether you can sue a cop, right?
Right.
And I think the compromise might be that you can sue the police force.
Yeah.
As opposed to the cop.
Exactly.
So that might... So I know you can't talk much more about it or any more about it, you know. But I think there's hope here, right?
There's hope. That's the key thing, is that there is hope. The hope is that the Republicans are still at the table and they're still negotiating. And the issue of qualified immunity is definitely one of the key sticking points. But we're still negotiating on it. So they've not walked away from that.
Well, that's encouraging. That's encouraging. Mm-hmm. And congratulations on the book. It's a bestseller.
It is.
The New York Times bestseller. And
yeah, I've never written anything. So this is great.
Well, it's very you. I mean, I must say, it's very your voice, very your story, obviously. But I enjoyed reading it, and glad I'm in it. I got that little thing where I look good. I look good in it.
Yeah, you're in it because you were there for me at Walter Reed, and you weren't using me as part of the MPD petting zoo. You were there for me, and you thanked me for being grievously wounded, so.
Well, thanks again for being grievously wounded. That'll be the second time in this interview. And thank you a third time. Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.